On a dusty road in southern Italy, sometime in the early 5th century BCE, a small procession of young men walks behind an older figure. They are heading toward the city of Elea, a Greek colony on the Tyrrhenian coast. Trade ships move in the harbor. Farmers bring goods into the market. Priests tend to local shrines. The older man is not a politician, not a general, not a seer. He is a poet and a thinker, Parmenides of Elea. And the poem he has composed will strike at the heart of how human beings think about reality. Behind him, though they do not yet know it, trails a revolution in the very idea of what it means for something to be. Parmenides leaves us only one work that we know of, a philosophical poem usually called On Nature. Like Hesiod and other early Greek writers, he casts his thought into hexameter verse. But the poem is not a mythic genealogy of gods or a collection of heroic tales. It is a journey, literally and intellectually. The speaker, a young man, is carried in a chariot along the path of the gods. The horses are described as eager, the wheels of the chariot as glowing. The route is guarded by maidens, daughters of the sun, who guide him toward the gates that separate the realm of day from night. At those gates stands a goddess, unnamed in the surviving text, who receives him and promises to reveal not only the truth, but also the beliefs of mortals in which there is no true trust. The opening is still recognizably mythic. Chariots, cosmic gates, radiant maidens, a goddess revealing hidden things. If you heard only this part, you might expect the rest to be some visionary cosmology or religious revelation. And in a sense, it is. But the goddess does not go on to describe a family of gods or a history of the world or rituals to be performed. Instead, she lays out a logical distinction that will reverberate through the entire history of Western philosophy. She tells the young seeker that there are only two ways of inquiry. One says, it is. The other says, it is not. Only one of these, she insists, can be walked, and that is the way that affirms it is. The other is utterly unthinkable and unsayable, because you cannot think or speak what is not. It sounds, at first hearing, almost trivial. Of course, you might think to talk about something is to talk about what exists in some sense. But Parmenides pushes this simple point with relentless rigor. If you say it is not, you are either speaking nonsense or secretly smuggling in some notion of what is. You cannot think pure nothing. There is no object there for your thinking to latch onto. So the very attempt to describe becoming, change or non-being, ends up covertly presupposing being. From that starting point, Parmenides draws conclusions that seem to tear the visible world to pieces. Once you accept that only what is can be thought or spoken, and that what is not cannot even be conceived, several things follow. First, what is cannot have come into being, for that would mean it sprang from what is not, from nothing, and that is impossible. Likewise, it cannot pass away into nothing. Being cannot be generated from non-being or dissolve back into it, because there is no such thing for it to arise from or fall into. Second, what is cannot be incomplete or divided. If there were gaps in it, those gaps would be what is not, which again is unthinkable. Therefore, the reality that truly is must be ungenerated, imperishable. We live in a world where things are constantly coming into being. Children are born, plants sprout, fires ignite. Things also pass away. People die, leaves fall, flames go out. The ordinary experience of life is one of flux and multiplicity. Parmenides does not deny that this is how things appear, but he denies that such appearances tell us anything about what truly is. The senses, he suggests, mislead us. They present a picture of a changing, many-formed world. Reason, by contrast, if it strictly follows the trail of what is, discovers that reality at its core cannot be multiple, cannot change, cannot have internal difference. There is just being, one, continuous, indivisible. The goddess in his poem marks the distinction clearly. First, she gives the account of the way of truth, the strict reasoning about being and not being, leading to the conclusion that reality is one and unchanging. Then, almost as a concession, she turns to the beliefs of mortals, describing how humans, driven by their senses, imagine that there are two fundamental principles, light and night, or fire and darkness, from whose mixture the many things of the world are formed. She calls this a deceptive ordering of words, a plausible but ultimately false story. She will lay it out, she says, so that the listener will not be outdone in the realm of mortal opinion. But the truth lies with the prior argument. Parmenides, in other words, splits his account. On one side stands rational necessity. Being is, cannot not be, and must have certain attributes, ungenerated, eternal, one, motionless. On the other stands the entire realm of empirical experience, birth, death, difference, motion, multiplicity. He will describe the latter, but only as a kind of as if, a concession to human habits of thought. The real weight falls on the former. To be a philosopher, on this view, is to align oneself with the way of truth, even when it contradicts the testimony of the senses. This is perhaps the most radical act of abstraction in all early Greek thought. The Milesians before him had tried to explain the world by finding a primary stuff, water, air, the indefinite, and showing how it changes into different forms. Heraclitus, slightly earlier or contemporary, had insisted that everything is in flux, that war is the father of all, that you cannot step into the same river twice. Parmenides comes along and says, in effect, you are all still playing in the realm of opinion if you think in terms of becoming, change, and plurality. The moment you take the distinction between is and is not seriously, your hands are tied. No room remains for genuine change or multiplicity at the level of what truly is. You can imagine the shock this would have posed. For someone like Heraclitus, the visible world of fire and transformation is the fundamental reality. Stability is an illusion produced by our tendency to freeze snapshots. For Parmenides, the roles are reversed. Stability, timeless, undifferentiated being, is what really is. Change is the illusion, or at least a lower order phenomenon that cannot belong to being itself. To use later language, he shifts the ontological priority. Eternity trumps time. Unity trumps multiplicity. Identity trumps difference. That stance will shape everything that comes after. Wrestle deeply with Parmenides' challenge. In The Republic and other dialogues, he will distinguish between the changing world of sense, where things come to be and pass away, and the unchanging world of forms, which truly are what they are. The form of justice, or the form of beauty, does not come into being or perish. It simply is. Our opinions about just acts may shift. Particular beautiful things may decay. But the form itself is stable. This move, dividing reality into a realm of becoming and a realm of being, is, in many ways, a sophisticated attempt to respond to Parmenides. It says, "You were right, Parmenides, that true being must be changeless. But you were wrong to deny all reality to the changing world. Let us grant being in a lower sense to the realm of becoming, while reserving full, proper being to the forms." Aristotle, too, will build his metaphysics under Parmenides' shadow. When he distinguishes between potentiality and actuality, when he tries to make sense of change as the actualization of a potency, rather than the coming to be of something from nothing, he is trying to protect the insight that nothing comes from nothing, while still leaving room for real motion and development. If something comes to be hot from being cold, Aristotle will say, this is not being emerging from non-being. It is one determination giving way to another within a subject that remains. Being in a broad sense persists. The modes of being shift. You can feel behind this the pressure of Parmenides' logic. Do not posit non-being as a source or partner, or you will be speaking nonsense. But Parmenides himself does not give us these conciliatory distinctions. he draws the line hard, to say that what is not in any way is to entangle oneself in contradiction. Every time you talk about something coming into being, you are, if you are not careful, imagining a passage from non-being to being or being to non-being. His warning is that this is conceptually incoherent. The only way out, as he sees it, is to say that becoming and perishing are not ultimately real. They belong to the deceptive doxa, the realm of appearance and naming, not to the level at which reason speaks without contradiction. There is an austere beauty in this. The description of what is in his poem becomes almost liturgical in its repetition. Unborn, imperishable, whole, of a single kind, unshaken, complete. It neither was nor will be, because it simply is now, all at once. It does not admit of more or less. It does not have parts that differ. It fills out all that there is to fill, like a sphere equally poised from the center in every direction. The image of the sphere is powerful. It suggests something without edges, without irregularities, without gaps. It also suggests something self-contained and self-sufficient. For a project like your podcast, which traces moral philosophy, the question arises, why does this stark metaphysical vision matter ethically? Parmenides himself does not develop a detailed account of virtue or justice in the surviving fragments, but his reorientation of thought has several implications. First, he decisively privileges reason over the senses. If you must choose between what rational argument demands and what sight, hearing, and touch present, you should choose the former. This is the beginning of the philosopher's willingness to distrust appearances in the name of an invisible order. Later moral thought will often lean on this. The just life, the good life, may not look attractive to ordinary observers. It may require resisting immediate impulses, standing apart from what everyone sees and everyone says. The example of Parmenides gives a template. Truth is not decided by how things look, but by how they must be if thought is to avoid contradiction. Second, his identification of reality with what is fully one, unchanging, and complete will encourage later thinkers to link the highest good with something similarly stable. In Plato, the form of the good is beyond change. In later religious philosophy, God is often described in Parmenidean terms, unchanging, eternal. Simple without parts, pure act without potentiality. If you think the ultimate reality is like that, then you may also think that the ultimate fulfillment of the human soul lies in some kind of participation in, or contemplation of, that timeless reality, rather than in the fluctuating satisfactions of the senses. Moral life becomes, to some degree, a movement away from identification with change and toward alignment with what does not pass away. Third, Parmenides. Refusal to grant any reality to non-being will seep into ethical argument about the impossibility of vice having substance in itself. In some later traditions, evil is described as a privation, a lack of good rather than a positive presence. That idea, though it develops much later, finds an ancestor in Parmenides' insistence that to speak of what is not as if it were something is to talk nonsense. The structure runs, being is, non-being is not. Therefore, anything that seems opposed to being has, at most, a parasitic, derivative status. It is a deformation, not an independent power. Parmenides does not say this about morality, but the logical shape of his thought makes such moves natural. If we step back into his own time, though, Parmenides is not yet a revered authority. He is a challenging voice in a landscape of competing ideas. Some of his younger contemporaries or immediate successors take his conclusions and run with them in startling ways. Zeno of Elea, his most famous associate, becomes known for clever paradoxes designed to defend Parmenides' claim that motion and plurality are impossible. Achilles cannot catch the tortoise. An arrow in flight is at rest in each instant. A moving body must reach the halfway point before the end, and the quarter before the halfway, and so on indefinitely. These arguments are not mere games. They are meant to show that if you try to make coherent sense of motion and multiplicity, you end up in contradiction. Better, Zeno implies, to accept Parmenides' difficult conclusion that there is really only the one. Others respond by trying to accommodate his insights without abandoning the many. Empedocles, for example, will say that nothing ever truly comes to be or perishes. The four roots, earth, air, fire, and water, are eternal and unchanging. What we call generation and corruption are just mixtures and separations. Love brings elements together. Strife tears them apart. In this way, Empedocles preserves the Parmenidean prohibition on something coming from nothing, while still granting reality to a world of plural changing arrangements. Anaxagoras, likewise, will argue that all things were together at first, and that mind, nous, set them in motion, separating and mixing them. For him, too, there is no absolute coming to be. There is reconfiguration. Even the atomists, Leucippus and Democritus, who seem at first to defy Parmenides by speaking of the void, are responding to his challenge. They posit tiny, indivisible atoms moving in empty space. To them, the void is not non-being in the absolute sense. It is a kind of non-fullness, a necessary condition for motion. They distinguish between what is full and solid, atoms, and what is no thing in the sense of lacking body, void, but both are part of the total explanation. In a way, they split being into two modes. Zeno and Parmenides would likely have found this unacceptable, but the atomists could say, we have kept the core intuition that something cannot come from nothing. We have just allowed for different kinds of is. This chain of responses shows how Parmenides forces every later cosmology to sharpen its concepts. You cannot casually talk about nothing as if it were something. You cannot invoke coming to be without answering his question, from what? You cannot posit plurality without explaining how difference does not smuggle in non-being. Even if you reject his conclusion that reality is a single, changeless sphere of being, you must account for the logical steps that got him there. If you imagine Parmenides in his old age, perhaps sitting in Elea, surrounded by younger thinkers arguing with him, he begins to look less like a mystic and more like a relentless logician. He was also, according to later tradition, involved in politics, perhaps even a lawgiver in his city. That fits the pattern. The same mind that insists on internal consistency in thinking would likely insist on coherent, stable laws in the polis. To legislate is to impose an order that does not fluctuate with every whim. To philosophize, in his style, is to impose an order on thought that does not bend under the pressure of appearance. The poem's mythic frame is not just decoration. The chariot journey, the gates, the goddess, these elements signal that what is being revealed is not merely an opinion among others, but something that claims a kind of necessity. The goddess tells the youth that he must learn all things, both the unshaken heart of well-rounded truth and the opinions of mortals in which there is no true trust. That double lesson is important. She does not tell him to ignore the world of appearance altogether. She wants him to understand it, to be able to navigate it, even to out-argue others within it. But she also wants him to know at a deeper level that it does not have the last word. This double vision is not so far from what later philosophers will call the distinction between the phenomenal and the noumenal, between the world as it appears and the world as it is in itself. Parmenides' way of truth is like a bare-bones noumenal account. There is being, one and complete. His way of opinion is a phenomenal map. Here's how things appear to mortals who trust their senses and name things according to day and night, light and dark, hot and cold. To know both is to live in two registers at once. For a modern listener, this can feel abstract, even alien. Our everyday language takes change for granted. We talk easily about things beginning and ending, about possibilities that might become actual, about nothingness as a kind of blank canvas. Parmenides invites us to slow down and hear how odd some of that talk is if you press it literally. What does it mean to say that something came from nothing? Can nothing in that sentence really be understood as an origin? What does it mean to say that a thing both is and is not in the process of changing? He is not just being difficult. He is forcing us to examine the basic grammar of our thinking. In moral and existential terms, there is a further, less often noticed thread. If the ultimate reality is unchanging being, then our own mortality and changefulness sit in an uneasy relation to that. One strand of later thought will try to resolve the tension by saying that what is most real in us is not our bodily flux, but our rational soul, which, in its highest activity, contemplates eternal truths. When we engage in that activity, we participate, however briefly, in the kind of being Parmenides describes. That idea will show up in Plato, in Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, in medieval Christian and Islamic philosophy. The best life is the one that orients itself toward what does not pass away. But there is another way to feel the tension. If reality is a timeless, unchanging one, then all our striving, our projects, our commitments, our stories may appear, from that vantage, as shadows. You can sense the danger of devaluing the human, historical, and relational aspects of life in favor of a cold abstraction. Philosophers after Parmenides will have to decide how far they are willing to follow him in that direction. Some, like Plato in certain moods, go quite far. Others, like Aristotle, try to keep one eye on the particular and changing. Much later, thinkers like Hegel and some existentialists will revolt, insisting that change, history, and becoming must be given a place in the heart of reality itself. In that sense, Parmenides is not just a figure in the distant past. He is the original voice of one side in a permanent argument. Is what is ultimately real something fixed and complete, or something that unfolds and becomes? If you lean toward the first, you are, in some measure, Parmenidean. If you lean toward the second, you are reacting against him, whether you know it or not. We do not know what Parmenides himself thought about the gods of traditional religion beyond the goddess in his poem. He does not, in the surviving lines, attack Homeric anthropomorphism as Xenophanes does. He does not talk about divine vices or virtues. His goddess is more like an allegorical figure of truth or necessity than a personal deity. Yet the way he speaks of what is has a quasi-divine tone. It is beyond birth and death, beyond change, self-sufficient, encompassing all. It is not addressed in prayer, but it has qualities that later theologians will be quick to map onto God. When Christian philosophers, for example, describe God as the one whose essence is existence itself, as pure being without admixture of not being, they are speaking a language that Parmenides helped make possible. Elea itself did not become a great philosophical center in later centuries. Athens, with its schools and public debates, will take that role. But for a brief period, this modest city on the Italian coast produced a cluster of thinkers, Parmenides, Zeno, and perhaps others, whose influence will stretch far beyond their local circumstances. It is one of those curious facts of intellectual history. A small, relatively peripheral community gives rise to ideas that set the agenda for centuries. You see the same pattern in Miletus earlier, and in medieval Cordoba or Baghdad later. What matters is not the size of the polis, but the intensity of reflection. When you present Parmenides in your series on Western moral philosophy, you do not need to turn him into an ethicist in the modern sense. You can instead show your listeners how he transformed the background picture of reality on which later moral systems would rely. Before him, it was still possible to think of the cosmos in terms of shifting powers and stories. After him, any serious thinker has to say something about being and not being, about permanence and change, about the relation between appearance and what must be. He is the one who asks, with an almost ruthless simplicity, what is it to be, and what happens to our familiar world if we take the answer seriously? Seen in that light, the image of the youth in the chariot is not an arbitrary poetic flourish. It is a symbol of what philosophy itself will often demand. You leave the city of familiar opinions. You travel along a path that feels at times like it is leading you away from everything recognizable. You pass through gates that separate one way of seeing from another. On the other side, what you encounter may be austere, even unsettling. A picture of reality in which many of your previous attachments look shallow. But you also gain, if Parmenides is right, a kind of unshakable ground. You can say, with him and his goddess, it is, and it is not possible for it not to be. From that sentence, an entire metaphysics and in time an entire moral outlook will unfold.
Midnight rails under silver moon, Dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and left me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea. Her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories. I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else to be. 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 Sunrise paints the horizon gold, but it don't warm a lonesome soul. Every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. I whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find a brand new path beyond the pain where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be.